Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the bizarre, rambling Rose Garden press conference on Friday, at which President Trump acknowledged he would sign the bipartisan funding bill to keep the government open, but then announced his declaration of a national emergency to get extra funding for his wall. Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, who previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, joins us to discuss what tools the Congress has to thwart Trump's usurpation of executive authority with his raid on the congressional purse strings. We'll assess the likelihood that there will be a split among Republicans in the Senate over going along with this unconstitutional act, but probably not enough to override a presidential veto, which the White House promised today, and how the battle in the courts will play out as the ACLU and a number of states sue the Trump administration. We'll also look into the validity of comparisons made by conservative pundits justifying Trump's action to the Obama administration's executive actions on the Affordable Care Act and the Dreamers, even though it is clear that Obama did not make use of a national emergency declaration to get his way. Then we'll examine further the unsettling display of the leader of the free world addressing the press and the nation from the White House in a disjointed, freewheeling, fact-free display of alternative reality in a 50-minute verbal, political, and psychological train wreck. Dr. Alan Francis, a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University, and the author of Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, joins us to discuss the sad display of our leader as a weak strongman clearly out of his depth and desperately in need of an intervention. We'll also look into the broader question of how could the citizens of our country have elected somebody so manifestly unqualified and unsuited for the job. Then finally, we'll get an assessment of the White House's embarrassing roadshow in Europe, having dispatched the Vice President and Secretary of State first to Warsaw, then Munich, to discuss freedom and democracy in a country, Poland, which is in the midst of turning away from democracy towards authoritarianism. Then at the security conference in Munich, at which our NATO allies were disparaged by the Trump team, unable to explain its Middle East policy or nuclear arms control policies, let alone its affection for autocrats like Putin. R. Daniel Kellerman, director of the Center for European Studies at Rutgers University, joins us to review America's latest pratfall on the world stage. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America, among many other topics. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, and she is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. Welcome to Background Briefing, Caroline Fredrickson.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. It's a lot. You laid out a lot of issues that have just, I have to say, a lot happens every day now in America that requires us to put our analytical hats on as well as anticipate frightening outcomes. Really is a unique, I hope a unique era in American history of trauma for all of
right.
us.
Right. I think it's, I would say, a unique and hopefully transitory moment, because I don't know that we can continue to have government by manufactured crisis and government by stunt on a daily basis. But I did actually watch the entire press conference on Friday in the Rose Garden. I don't know whether you did, Caroline, but it was truly an extraordinary display. It was almost like, you know, you sort of one of those sort of Thanksgiving dinners that go wrong with a crazy uncle, and you just everybody goes off to another room and quietly discusses an intervention. Do you see an intervention? At least let's talk in terms of a constitutional intervention. I don't understand how he's gotten this far. I would have thought, with Article 1 of the Constitution being so clear, that he's already overstepped the bound. So what mechanism is there to thwart this power grab?
Well, you know, I assume you're talking about the particular power grab in the moment is the declaration of an emergency.
Right.
And, you know, I found myself in the rather remarkable position, I think, of agreeing with Ann Coulter
right.
for once. And Ann Coulter said, there's only one national emergency, and that's the doofus, or some other word she used.
Idiot.
In the White House. And I thought, I guess every, you know, once a century or something, one can agree with Ann Coulter on something. She's clearly right. There's no emergency here. The president said it himself. He said, I don't have to do this. We all know that crossings are way down from where they've been. You know, there's certainly a crisis in the sense that there are people really suffering at the border. There are children, there are families, there are still children who were separated from their parents who haven't been found. So, I mean, I don't want to say there's no crisis, but the only crisis there is the one that was created by Trump, and certainly not one that requires the use of unappropriated funds to build a wall.
But what is the House, the declaration of disapproval, I think that's what it's called, mm-hmm. that will clearly pass the House.
Termination, I think.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So that is the response from the Congress whose powers are being usurped by the executive branch. So if that's the best salvo they can fire, my understanding is that there will be some Republicans in the Senate who will vote along the House lines, and assuming the House passes it overwhelmingly.
Well,
go ahead.
So the way that the law was the statute was written, the National Emergencies Act, was that it's a privileged resolution. And so once it passed the House, it has to be taken up by the Senate within 18 days. It's a majority vote. It can't be filibustered. It seems pretty clear that there are enough Republicans that they will get a majority. You know, but then, as you mentioned earlier, the president's going to veto that resolution. And the problem that we have is that the law's a mess. The National Emergencies Act was passed in 1976 when they believed that there could just be a majority vote of Congress to reject an emergency. The Supreme Court said that's not true, that the president does have the power to veto so that means that you're always going to have a supermajority requirement to overcome the president. So that's why I think litigation is the next route. Now, of course, it's going to be an important moment to get Republicans on the record to show where they stand. You know, I was just reading some stories this morning about climate change and thinking, okay, now here's an emergency. Here's an actual emergency that our government has not grappled with sufficiently. And in fact, the Trump administration is dismantling what President Obama was able to do. So there's an emergency. And so I think, you know, by running roughshod over the norms that have governed the executive branch, President Trump is certainly setting down a precedent that could be used by future presidents to actually address real emergencies, but with the danger of cutting Congress out of the process.
Well, but this is if we get into a situation of adjudicating what's a real emergency and what's not, one would have thought that would have been written into the statutes.
Right. Unfortunately, they really didn't define emergency. But we do know, that it has never been used this way ever when Congress has actually disagreed with the president's request for funding, has rejected it, and then the president has decided that he wants the money anyway. It has been the emergency power has been used many times. But what President Trump is doing is a direct body blow to Article 1 of the Constitution, which is what sets out Congress's power, and most specifically, Congress has the power of the purse. They control the money, not the president.
And again, I'm speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America, among many other topics. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, and she is the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. So already you've got a number of states suing the administration, along with the ACLU and Public Citizens also representing a number of landowners on the border with the Texas and Mexico, whose land is about to be, seized, I guess, under eminent domain. So I don't know whether, if there's so many lawsuits, what's going to be what's going to go through the process that Trump himself enunciated in his rambling press conference on Friday? He said, it'll go to the Ninth Circuit and then they'll turn it down and then it'll go through the appeals and then they'll rule against me and then it'll get to the Supreme Court where I'll get a fair shake. So tell me about that process.
Well, I think the cases will be filed in many courts. Despite what the president says, it's most one of the places there will most likely be a lawsuit will be actually in right here in the District of Columbia, where I am, in challenging the federal government's actions. The D.C. District Court and the D.C. Circuit Court are the usual places for that. And when Congress sues, which it will, the House of Representatives is going to sue. And the Republicans already once again blazed a pathway here. They sued President Obama when he used funds to make sure that the Affordable Care Act wouldn't implode. And they were outraged by the president's abuse of power and by his reprogramming of money. Now, he didn't do anything that was in deliberate, had been rejected by Congress, and he didn't declare an emergency, so it's not entirely a similar situation at all. But what the Republicans did was they went to the D.C. court and they were argued that they had standing to sue. And the judge found that they did, in fact, have standing. So therefore, they could bring a lawsuit. Well, that is the precedent on the books. Clearly, the House of Representatives has standing in this case to object to funding a program that they had already rejected. So that's going to be one place. Certainly the Ninth Circuit is also a possibility because California is suing and California is in the Ninth Circuit and, parts of the, border are in the Ninth Circuit. There'll be lawsuits in Texas. There will be lawsuits, in a variety of places because there's a lot of negative impact from what the president plans to do. And you mentioned there are property owners, there are wildlife refuges, there are other types of conservation issues that are going to be affected by dividing up territory, by building constructions. There's a church that's trying to protect its property that's already in litigation, I believe. So there are going to be a lot of lawsuits, and this is, I don't know if this will actually be resolved by the time the president leaves office.
Well, but it will.
Hope.
Yeah, but will he be able to, is it shovel ready, in other words? Are they going to start building this thing, whatever it's called, wall, barrier, fence, you name it? It changes all the time.
Well, you can't just go and seize people's land this way. You actually have to. There is litigation that's going to have to happen. And even if the courts try and expedite it, that's not something the president just can run roughshod over people. As well as all of the other statutes that have been set in place, again, to provide for conservation areas. There are national parks. There are other wildlife refuges that that are all otherwise protected. And so there's going to be a variety of legal disputes that have to be resolved. Which is not to say it's going to be something that people can sit back and just and forget about. Because for the people who are down there, it's going to be a real struggle to make sure that the president doesn't just, steamroll them.
Well, it's so clear that this whole thing is entirely to do with shoring up his base and trying to save face with him because he's obviously completely out of his depth and totally incompetent, doesn't know about how government works. And he got completely smoked by Nancy Pelosi, and now he's trying to make himself look like a tough guy when, in fact, the visuals, not to mention the audibles from the extraordinary display in the Rose Garden, essentially painted a picture of a weak strongman totally out of his depth. And we'll be talking in a little while to a psychiatrist who's sort of studied rampant narcissism and what happens when condition known as narcissistic mortification, when somebody who's a narcissist is faced with reality. Of course, our president, Donald Trump, completely changed this reality. I don't know whether you noticed, Caroline, but now he said he's already finished the wall, or a lot of it's been built, which is not true. And his new motto is not build the wall and have Mexico pay for it, but finish the wall. So this is what's amazing. He will change the reality whenever it doesn't work out for him. So is there any way we can sort of present him with a different reality so he'll just go away and stop doing so much harm?
Well, here's the thing. I think it's imperative that people exercise one of the few rights that we still have, or at least partially, and that is vote. People need to get out there and express their opinions about this administration through the ballot box. And, you know, I'm not endorsing any party or any candidate, but the only way to really make a change here, unless and until the Senate Republicans decide that they care about the Constitution, is to actually be engaged in the political process. And I think, you know, one of the unfortunate aspects of our constitutional structure is the Electoral College. You know, in order to overcome that, people need to vote in high percentages. So I don't want to say that we have to wait 2 years before anything changes, because obviously things are already changing. And because people spoke out in the last election, there is now a House of Representatives that's actually exercising its oversight capabilities. And a variety of things are going to happen out of that. But I do think it's really important that people don't become too cynical and don't become passive, even though Trump can, you know, provoke a lot of cynicism. But the answer is actually to engage and get better people. Because what you said about Nancy Pelosi was really inspiring. I mean, she went toe-to-toe with this weak, strong man, which that's a phrase I will have to plagiarize. I think it's terrific. And she stared him down, and she absolutely won that battle. It's winnable. So I think we have to be strong, we have to be focused, and we have to make sure that we vote.
Well, just in closing, though, my understanding about the Constitution and making the Congress the Article I and giving them the power of the purse was because the king, the English king, the mad king at the time, had total control of the purse. And so they decided, the Founding Fathers, that they didn't want another king and they didn't want him controlling the purse, and that the king would have to ask for money. And the Congress, the representatives of the people, would decide whether he gets it or not. And Trump is blowing up that arrangement. And that's what I'm puzzled by. Do we just have to sort of patiently wait for it to all go through the courts? I'm astounded that it's never happened before in the history of this country, as far as I know. I'm surprised that there's not a more robust mechanism to stop him.
Well, it's true. I think we've all been really surprised, amazed, dismayed by the fact that our structure is actually so weak, that many things that we thought were laws are actually just practice. You know, the president showing his tax returns, that's just a practice. A variety of norms that we've come to expect about the president disclosing his financial status, about removing himself from financial entanglements to set up a blind trust and all of those things. Well, all those things were just practices, and that's not good enough. And so I think, you know, many of us are engaged in a process of taking this moment and analyzing where are those weaknesses that when you have somebody like Trump who is going to exploit, well, he's even broken the law, clearly, but certainly where there's no legal constraint and it's just a norm and a practice, he's going to blow a hole through that. So, you know, we're working on a variety, and H.R. 1 is a perfect, perfect beginning. It really, it's admirable because it addresses a myriad of problems, from campaign finance issues to voter suppression to ethics. It's a comprehensive democracy restoration bill that I think it's really important that people engage on that and support it. You know, but even if you don't know about it, look into it. It's the first bill that the House leadership introduced in the new Congress, and I think it is the right response to really look broadly and deeply at where are the weak links in our system.
Well, Caroline Fredrickson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Caroline. Again, I've been speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, president of the American Constitution Society, where she focuses on issues such as civil and human rights, judicial nominations, and the importance of the courts in America. She previously served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, and she's the author of Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. We're going to take a brief station break and back, examining further the unsettling display of the leader of the free world addressing the press and the nation from the White House in a disjointed, freewheeling, fact-free display of alternative reality in a 50-minute verbal, political, and psychological train wreck.
What's in your head is really started showing. Your conversation's getting kind of boring. Don't believe nothing you say, 'cause I'm around and I see what you do. You know you're funkier than a mosquito splitter. You got a mouth like a herd of boll weavers.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dr. Alan Francis, who's a professor emeritus and former chair of psychiatry and behavioral science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now just out in a paperback updated version. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Alan Francis.
Oh, very nice to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thanks. I don't know whether you saw the entire press conference, the 50-minute press conference on Friday in the Rose Garden. I sat through the whole thing, and I must say I was absolutely aghast at this sort of display of a kind of weak strongman, you know, alternatively lashing out with defiance and then sort of sulking with aggrievement. And I guess the general impression I got was that this is a man completely out of his depth. And I think as a nation, we need an intervention. How does it strike you?
Well, it depends on what pool you think he's swimming in. So in terms of rational discourse and proper policy and the future of our world and the fate of our grandchildren, he's a complete total idiot and a disaster and a great risk. If the pool you're swimming in is political calculation, exploitation of others, setting yourself up for the 2020 election, he's a blooming genius. And the things that appear to us to be absolutely absurd and disqualifying in him as a president are to some people, and it's puzzling, we don't understand them very well, but to some people are the source of cultish worship and admiration. And I think he's made a calculation, a clever calculation, about his audience. He had great ratings for a TV show for 10 years, and he runs his presidency as if it's a TV show. He doesn't care that much about people who don't like him. He knows he's not going to ever win their approval. So the purpose of his diatribes are to keep the faith with those people who are fooled by him or cynically using him. And if he has and continues to have 40% of the population approving of his ridiculous behavior, all he has to do is trick and connive another 6%. And he's proven once before that he's able to get that extra 6%. And so I see him as a genius and a jackass, a genius at exploiting others and self-promoting himself, and a most dangerous threat to democracy since the institution of democracy in our country 240 years ago.
But he's not doing this alone. I think without Rupert Murdoch, without the propaganda apparatus, none of this would be working, I would assume, because the 40% that you're talking about who support him are in this bubble of delusion where they're immune to facts and evidence, and they do have a cult-like adherence to their dear leader. Until the propaganda bubble is burst, I don't see how you can stop it. Oh, do we lost him all of a sudden? Okay, well, we'll quickly call back and get Dr. Alan Francis back on the line, to Professor Emeritus and the former Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book just out is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now out in an updated paperback version. Alan, are you back?
Yes.
Sorry, we just dropped you out. So you just dropped out. But the question was, until you deal with the propaganda mechanism that keeps his base hermetically sealed in this bubble of delusion where they're immune to facts and evidence, I don't see how you can stop this situation.
Yeah, this has been 40 years in the making or more, that the Koch brothers and other billionaires have been financing a radical right kleptocratic takeover, grabbing up different radio stations, TV outlets, and now exploiting the internet with all sorts of false messaging. Trump is just a symbol. He's just a symptom of our national disease. He's certainly not the underlying disease itself. And the cure is certainly not just getting rid of Trump, because Pence and people like him who are more plausible may be even more dangerous. I think we have to go beyond the surface crudity of Trump to understand the greedy cleverness of what amounts to a quiet, slow, inexorable coup to try to subvert the institutions of democracy and to put all of the power in the country to concentrate it in the hands of the very few who have already succeeded in concentrating great wealth and therefore have the kind of gravity that allows them to provide 24/7 deceptive messages to a public that's either very, very gullible, or in some cases, especially the GOP Congress, very, very cynical.
So one of the things that happened in the election, which Trump, of course, was 3 million short in the popular vote, and that's another discussion for another day. But the person that he did not criticize ever was Bernie Sanders. And there was an interesting crossover. Many of the Bernie Sanders supporters were Trump supporters and vice versa. So my sense is that until the Democratic Party deals with the reality of populism and why people voted for Trump, they simply are not going to learn from their mistakes. And don't you think that's at the heart of it, is that the people who voted for Trump were not stupid? They had every reason and every right to be completely disillusioned with the government.
Yeah, I think what the Democrats should be doing, you were just addressing this in the previous interview, I think they should pass a series of bills that would be a real contract for America, beginning with voting rights and equity, but very quickly there should be a tax bill that rights the wrongs of the previous Trump giveaway to the rich and to the corporations and would provide clear-cut substantial gains to the middle class. I think that the health bills need to be rewritten. And I realize that they won't be passed by the Senate, but it should at least force a Senate vote. We need to have universal coverage, and we need to control drug prices. We need to control hospital prices. The majority of the population is clearly behind this, behind the tax, fair tax system. I would have the Democrats regain their constituency. The Democratic coalition, up until the Koch brothers and other false advertising, the Democratic coalition was basically the working man. and they've lost this because of the focus that's been placed on irrational fear of migrants, of racial hate speech, of misogyny. The Republicans have been able to use cultural issues, anger at gays, cultural issues to get the working class angry at the Democratic Party, not angry at the very rich people who are putting their hands in their pockets and stealing their livelihood and taking away their jobs. So I think that the Democrats have been elite, have been focused on their own constituency, have not reached out to their natural constituency, which is the people that they most defend but least understand and least appeal to. And I think Trump can be beaten, the Republicans can be beaten, but it has to be done smarter. It's a lot easier to frame lies than to tell the truth. And people who know they're lying are usually better at framing the message than people who think that the truth is enough. The truth is not enough. It has to be packaged in a way that's easily understandable. And I think that this is a crucial time in American democracy and in the fate of the world. I think that the global warming is a threat that is much deeper and more pervasive than the threat to democracy. But if we don't solve the threat to democracy, we're not going to solve global warming. I think it's crucial that the Democratic Party frame bill after bill and pass about six or seven decent, well-meaning bills that take into account the needs of the people who've been left behind, the opioid epidemic, another target, gun control, an interesting, difficult, but still, I think, possible target if you focus on assault weapons, and to have a very clear platform laid down. It shouldn't be that Trump is dictating the discourse. There has to be a reasoned, enlightened approach towards the needs of the people who've been left out because of globalization and brainwashed through the quotes populism of the very rich.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Francis, Professor Emeritus and former Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now just out in a paperback updated version. So, Dr. Francis, is there, though, a learning curve for Trump's base in this? You know, we talked about them being in the bubble of delusion that Rupert Murdoch and Sinclair and Limbaugh and company have created for them, where they are, where it's pretty difficult to reach them with facts and reality. But on the other hand, there are other ways for reality to reach these people. For example, the giveaway to the rich, the only achievement of Trump so far in terms of having something passed into law, is the tax cut for the super rich. Now the average American is finding in their income tax return that they're getting 10% less, because that's how the Republicans raided the till in order to make up for the giveaway to the rich. So will that have an effect when people realize that they've been had?
Well, I've spent my whole life studying human psychology, and I thought I had a pretty good handle on it, but I'm befuddled. It makes no sense for a man like Trump to be able to command 40% of our population. It makes no sense for the religious right to take the most unchrist-like individual maybe since Christ and make him there to worship him as a kind of false god. It makes no sense to have him do things that are economically directly disadvantageous to them and still have them come to rallies and cheer him as if he's the new Messiah. Whether or not that, I would have guessed by now that his support would have been in the low teens, and that's not happened. And I don't think we can count on that happening for the next election. I think it's important to try to make clear policies that are very helpful in terms of the opioid epidemic, health coverage, fair taxation. I think that we have to chip away as much as possible at his, quote, populist appeal to the base. But I think a wiser policy would be not to count on that exclusively, and to work very hard to get out the vote and the people who are already disaffected by Trump but might not otherwise appear at the polls. I think that getting out the vote amongst college students, it's their future. College students are 70% or higher in their disapproval of Trump, but they don't vote much. I think there has to be a nationwide campaign amongst youngsters. I think that the different minority groups have to be mobilized in a way they never have been before. There is way too low a turnout amongst African Americans, amongst Latinos, amongst Muslims, amongst Asians in this last election. I think that women are beginning to really exert their influence, and it's crucial. It's not just enough to have more candidates in Congress. It's crucial that the female volunteers and female voters determine this next election. So I think the Democrats need to do two things at the same time. One is to get their message across to Trump's base. And certainly we hope that some of that base is friable and that the Democrats will be able to make clear that the self-interest of the people voting for Trump is not served by Trump, that he's a false messenger of their message. But at the same token, I think this is going to be a brute force election. It's also likely to be in part determined by tricks and rigging and voter fraud. And it's very important to pass the legislation, but it won't pass the Senate, and it's equally important to do our best to shame those Republicans who have been so skillful in keeping people away from the ballot box.
But what seems to be happening, though, Dr. Francis, is that the campaign for president has already started, and there's quite a big field of Democrats that's likely to get bigger. And we're already into the horse race. I myself have been covering it, albeit reluctantly, but, you know, it's happening. You can't ignore people like, you know, senators announcing they're running for president. But on the other hand, you know, I think to myself, my God, you know, another, not just a year of this, 2 years of this, this is crazy. So one of the things that I think has served Trump very well, and that's, I think, in part why he got elected or why he did so well, particularly in the kind of reality TV Republican primary where the reality TV guy knocked everybody off the island and he was the last man standing. His main appeal was that I'm not a politician. And he kept making that clear. And he certainly, his behavior is completely unlike most politicians. So do you think that the Democrats need a non-politician? Is that a part of the problem, that people just simply are turned off by political jargon and the kind of rhythm and the way the politicians talk? Even if they're sincere, sometimes they just don't appear to be sincere.
Well, one of the things that worries me is this plethora of candidates. I think historically and psychologically, it's very clear that left movements tend to split while right movements tend to cohere, that there's all sorts of psychological literature suggesting that people on the right tend to have a follow-the-leader, authoritarian personality. And you notice how Trump was very unpopular until he was nominated, and then he's had remarkable loyalty ever since. Whereas on the Democratic side, there was very little difference in the policies between Sanders and Clinton, although I think people within each camp might see this differently from the perspective, my perspective at least, an outsider's perspective. They were much closer together than the 11 Republican candidates, but there was much more divisiveness after Clinton was chosen, and she lost the election because Sanders voters didn't come out in the force they could have for her. Historically, Hitler had only 41% of the German vote, but the left was split. Similarly with Mussolini, with Pinochet, and with Franco, that when the left is split, the right coheres and is able, with a minority government, to assume dictatorial powers, and Trump is trying to follow in that pattern. I think it's very important for the Democrats not to kill each other off, and I think that's likely to happen given this early excess of candidates. I think that the battle between the more moderate and the more left Democrats is very destructive to both. And they must realize that really the common enemy at this point is Donald Trump. And the common enemy is Rupert Murdoch and the Koch brothers and the Mercers. And that whatever differences may separate them, those should be settled after they've won the election. They shouldn't compromise the possibility of winning the election. It would be a terrible disaster for the country and the world if, as has happened in the last election, the Democrats fight and Trump is able to slip in again.
But as a psychiatrist, can you explain that phenomenon on the left where people would rather be righteous than effective?
Well, I had this debate with many, many friends before the election and after as well, that many people said to me, emailed to me or tweeted to me, I couldn't in conscience vote for Hillary Clinton. I couldn't in conscience vote for Hillary Clinton. That whatever reservations they had about her were so blinding that the difference between her and Trump was obscured. I think everyone has to be aware of the fact that at this point in the history of this country, democracy is remarkably fragile. There have been very few democracies in the history of the world, and they don't last. The famous Greek democracy lasted for less than a century and actually depended on slavery. Democracies don't last, and we see democracies falling all across the world in just the same way our democracy is falling. There can be no complacency about this next election. There can't be the settling of petty inside baseball, inside political feuds. I think everyone has to focus on one goal and one goal only, and that's saving democracy for the United States and saving the planet from a terrible, disastrous culling that's going to come from global warming unless we act soon, maybe almost too late already. That has to guide people. It's being mirrored in Britain now. Britain's about to go over a cliff while the Conservative and Labour parties have intra-party struggles over the small points of policy. There's a tendency for people to focus on narrow, short-term self-interest rather than to realize that we have a long-term planet to save and, in our country, long-term democratic institutions that are being threatened immediately. And the differences between the most moderate, the most rightest of Democrat and the most liberal of Democrat are tiny compared to the difference between the two of them together and what the Koch brothers, the Mercers, and the Murdochs of the world have in mind for us, and Trump is their instrument. So I think that there has to be, even though psychologically it's difficult for people on the left to mobilize together because we tend to be individualists and to like to make our own decisions and not to be too influenced by authority. This is not the time to express our individuality. This is a time to realize that our kids are under threat and we have to unite together.
Well, Dr. Alan Francis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, always.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Alan Francis, Professor Emeritus and former Chair of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science at Duke University. He's the author of the award-winning international bestseller Saving Normal and the reference work Essentials of Psychiatric Diagnosis. And his latest book is Twilight of American Sanity, A Psychiatrist Analyzes the Age of Trump, now just out in a paperback updated version. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Trump administration's clumsy diplomatic roadshow in Warsaw and Munich.
Come on now, who do you, who do you, who do you, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. You really think you're in control?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is our Daniel Kellerman, the Jean Monnet Chair and Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of Eurolegalism, the Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union, and The Rules of Federalism, Institutions and Regulatory Politics in the EU and Beyond. And he serves on the editorial board of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics, and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Kellerman.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And what did you make of the diplomatic roadshow that the U.S. put on the Trump administration this week? First, in Warsaw, where they talked about peace and freedom in a country that's turning into an autocratic direction. And recently, an opposition politician was stabbed to death at a political rally and turned that into an attempt to organize the new Europe, which is a division that the Trump administration seems to have seized on. And old Europe being our traditional allies and new Europe being the former Warsaw Pact countries. And then on to the security summit at Munich, at which the Secretary of State lambasted our European allies. So, and of course, while this was going on, Vladimir Putin was hosting a group in Sochi on the future of Syria with the leaders of Turkey and Iran. So this felt to me like a number of pratfalls on the world stage, frankly.
Yeah, I would say that overall, what I make of the two summits is, and the performance of the Trump administration there, is that it was a disaster in both counts. And, you know, frankly, some aspects were just embarrassing. You know, the famous scenes of Vice President Pence waiting for sort of applause when he said he was there bringing representing President Trump, and got a dead silence from the room. But more than that, more than those embarrassing moments, it was the strategy reflected in the U.S. stance at both summits that was really wrongheaded and really, I think, in the big picture, underlines how deep the rifts between the U.S. and its traditional European allies have become under the Trump administration. And I think, you know, the real question in people's minds is, can this be healed if and when a new administration comes to power in the U.S., or is there something more permanent damage that's already been done?
Well, if the intention was, as we assume it was, to unify our allies around a common cause, it seems like the whole thing backfired and it exposed this growing rift between the U.S. and Western allies that you just referred to. I mean, along with the kind of clumsy amateurism of it as well.
Yeah, well, of course, one of the big themes, if we start with the Warsaw summit, right, that was a sort of an odd summit that was convened basically together by the Polish government and U.S. government, or through the State Department, with the aim, and it was framed supposedly as a summit about peace in the Middle East and that sort of thing, but really the aim was to try to pull together a coalition against Iran, sort of under U.S. leadership. But there we really showed, again, you know, how isolated we were, because essentially we were trying to pressure our European allies, who are still part of the Iran nuclear deal, which the Trump administration abandoned, right? Try to pressure them to follow us and abandon that deal. But they don't want to, right? And although they have the same goal, in one sense, of, you know, preventing Iran from getting nuclear weapons, they see the nuclear deal as the way to pursue that. And so the U.S. essentially came away empty-handed from that conference. Not only that, I mean, the embarrassment was, we called this conference, sent the vice president, the secretary of state, but most of our European allies sent sort of mid-level officials. And you know, frankly, they image that U.S. leadership, such as it was under the Trump administration, would basically just amount to pressure to follow the U.S. line in these areas, as controversial as it is. And then the security summit, that had a broader agenda, of course. Just, it's a long-running summit, not an ad hoc one like the one in Poland. And the Munich Security Summit is traditionally one where we look at the issues in the transatlantic alliance and the kind of common interests of the allies. But again, there, what was really underlined was the deep rift between the Trump administration and our allies.
So what's going on, though, with this new dichotomy that the Trump administration is trying to draw in Europe with our new allies vis-a-vis our old allies? He's trashing our old allies, the traditional allies like Germany, UK, and France. But Pompeo, of course, paid court to the Hungarian regime of Viktor Orban, which is essentially an outlier in the EU. And they've embraced illiberal democracy, which is a cover for autocracy. And then, of course, hosting Poland hosting this conference, which, frankly, from all of the reports I saw, was essentially about helping Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel get reelected He seemed to be in the sort of star of it. Whatever their purposes were, that seemed to be the ultimate takeaway. And then going on to Munich, where with the old Europe, where they again trashed our allies and are completely unable. The Trump administration were unable to answer simple questions about how come you're supporting Mohammed bin Salman when the rest of the world knows that he ordered the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. How come you pulled out of the INF treaty without regard for you know, the future of arms control? And what in God's name is your policy in Syria? So for all of our bluster, we weren't able to answer, or the Trump administration wasn't able to answer pretty simple questions.
Yeah, well, so if we start with a question you raised about the relationship with some of these backsliding regimes in Eastern Europe, I mean, first, I'd like to say I don't think we should really center on the idea that there's some firm division between Eastern Europe, and these new allies and our old allies, in the sense that there's a lot of diversity within the governments in Eastern Europe, and a lot of them are fully on board with the sort of pro-liberal democracy focus of the traditional West European allies. But a couple of the governments you mentioned, such as the government in Hungary and in Poland and a couple others who are sliding in that direction, are challenging the kind of liberal democratic norms which have underpinned the Western alliance, so to speak. And so Hungary, some of your listeners may have noticed, was downgraded by Freedom House just last week. Freedom House is a research organization in Washington that for decades has ranked countries on their levels of freedom. And Hungary just became the first EU member state to officially be downgraded, so it's no longer considered a free country. It's moved into the category of partly free, with countries like Pakistan, Singapore, Zimbabwe, right? Poland still hasn't been downgraded quite there yet, but it's moving in that direction, and there's real concerns about the erosion of democracy there. So I think what the Trump administration was doing in kind of embracing, with Pompeo visiting the Hungarian government and then the conference in Poland, is signaling its support for this kind of soft autocracies that are emerging there. You heard our government praising the Polish government as being a bastion of freedom, et cetera, in the region, just as it's moving in the opposite direction. So I think that's very worrying. And then if we move on to the bigger picture in the other conference, I think really what's underlined, as I was saying before, is that our European allies by now have given up on the Trump administration providing any kind of leadership. They recognize the Trump administration is going to be a destructive force for the Western alliance. And the only real question, and this is where Joe Biden, who gave a speech there, was trying to make the appeal to say, we'll be back. Just hang in there. We shouldn't throw away ideas of NATO and the Western alliance. Be patient. This will end. And the real question for the Europeans is, how patient can they be? Can they really expect the alliance to return to what it was, or is the damage now permanent?
Well, along with former Vice President Biden, Nancy Pelosi was there as well. So it does. I don't know that this ever happened before, has it, Daniel Kellerman, where the United States has essentially been represented by the executive branch, by the former administration, and by the congressional branch, who were there to reassure our Western allies, that our traditional allies, at the Munich conference, that we'll return to business as normal as soon as Trump goes away.
Well, this is a conference that is where there have been members of Congress, of course, in the past, and people that were active in previous administrations. So that's not unheard of. Although this was the largest congressional delegation, I believe, that has ever showed up at the Munich Security Conference, and it was bipartisan. But I think there are members. Republican members of Congress were trying to emphasize that they still support and believe in the transatlantic alliance, and that whatever our allies think about the Trump administration, that doesn't represent necessarily or that their positions don't represent a consensus view within the Republican Party. So that is, I think, an effort to give hope that once there's a new administration, things can go a bit back close to what they were before. But again, the question really is, you know, how credible will that be? You know, once one of the partners in the alliance has, you know, really sort of broken trust, it's hard to restore that.
So what do you think, is there a comparison one can make with Putin's alternative summit in Sochi with Turkey and Iran?
Well, even before I say something about the conference in Sochi, I think it's worth mentioning that at the Munich conference itself, Lavrov was there representing the Putin government, and you know, he was making a pitch to the Europeans to say, you know, essentially, you can't really rely on America as an ally anymore. Why not, draw closer and find strategic partnerships, with Russia, with the Putin government? Now, of course, for a lot of European leaders, you know, that rings very hollow, and that's not going to get very far. But I think it is worth noting that some public opinion polls recently in Germany, for instance, shown that a lot of Germans, it's kind of shocking for American listeners, but a lot of Germans now see Russia and even China as more reliable actors in the security realm than the U.S. So that's the degree which they've sort of been shocked by the actions of the Trump administration. But Putin's conference, really, you know, it was just underlining the fact that while the U.S. was trying to pull together this alliance in the conference in Poland, as I said, to kind of counter Iran, and while that was looking like a failure, you know, meanwhile, you could see that Russia looked like it was standing up as the leader of a kind of an opposite pole, right, in trying to pull together leaders, like you said, from Iran and Turkey to find, you know, its favored solutions to security issues in the Middle East. So it's enabling Russia to sort of position itself as a leader in world affairs. I think it's worth noting that most of the U.S. moves recently that have been so controversial with our European allies have tended to serve Russian interests quite well.
Well, I think that was pretty inescapable, wasn't it, in much of the criticism from the traditional European allies, that particularly over Syria, they literally said, why pull out of Syria and hand it to Iran and Russia, particularly when you're beating the drum that we need to confront Iran? There's absolutely no consistency there.
Well, yeah, again, the only consistency seems to be that most of the actions of the Trump administration seem to serve Russian interests. Now, you know, we'll see in the end, hopefully, how much knowing, collusion with Russian leadership there is, you know, with President Trump, or, you know, the alternative is he's just sort of functioning as a kind of useful idiot for the Kremlin, sort of serving their interests. You know, we've seen these, you know, incredible statements, just reports in the Times, I think, this week where, for instance, on North Korea, that I believe it was where Trump said, he thought they couldn't launch missiles because, you know, the Russians had told him and he believed them. So, you know, he seems to have this relationship where he's taking strategic advice from Putin rather than from his own intelligence services.
Well, Daniel Kellerman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with our Daniel Kellerman, who's the Jean Monnet Chair and Director of the Center for European Studies and a Professor of Political Science at Rutgers University. He's the author of Eurolegalism, The Transformation of Law and Regulation in the European Union and The Rules of Federalism, Institutions and Regulatory Policies in the EU and Beyond. And he serves on the editorial board of the Journal of European Public Policy and West European Politics, and is a former member of the Executive Committee of the European Union Studies Association. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
the man she loves.